In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Cynthia Miller, when you first see her, is the most baby-faced of all the midwives in Call the Midwife. She is the most self-effacing. She is the least adventurous of all of those midwives, and yet she is fiercely devoted to every family that she helps bring a child into the world. And in that series on PBS, after many years of serving alongside midwives who are also nuns, she senses a call to become part of the religious order of nuns who are also midwives. And so she does that. She enters, after several months and years of reflection and prayer and discussions with others, she enters into that order, and she's given a new name, Sister Mary Cynthia. In a later episode, after she has entered that order, that episode opens with a scene of Sister Mary Cynthia having her morning devotions. And if you know anything about that series, it is told from the perspective of another midwife named Jenny decades later, right? In that scene, Sister Mary Cynthia is having her morning devotions, and the overdub is of Sister Jenny in her 70s saying these words that are on the front of your bulletin. The religious life was not one I could have chosen. To nurse is to be drawn into society, to interweave one's life with the business of strangers. It's about the world and flesh and what some people call the devil. To balance that with the setting apart of the heart and the quiet, closed existence of the spirit would have been beyond me altogether. But others saw the joy in that and sought to live it out, sustained and inspired by those who'd heard the call before them. Nurse Jenny's perception, at least according to that word, is that the religious life is one of detachment from the world. It is all about sort of sequestering, or literally and figuratively, cloistering yourself among the company of the saints and sort of leaving the great unwashed to take care of their work. That's the perception that Nurse Jenny has. But the wonderful irony of those words, which is intended by the producer of the show, is that Sister Mary Cynthia, in that episode, goes out to demonstrate the exact opposite of what Nurse Jenny speaks of here. Yes, Sister Mary Cynthia brings every thought captive to God in her quiet room. But for the rest of the episode, she goes out and demonstrates being very much in the world and the flesh and working with the wiles of the devil to be involved in the work of being present to her world. It's a great episode. I think we should all just sort of watch it together, and then Anita can help translate for us. It's the greatest show. 40% I never can understand. The irony and the sorrow is that many of the people outside the Christian faith hold that perception that Nurse Jenny does of those who are Christians, of the religious life. They think to be a Christian is to kind of sort of, we'll gather here in our holy huddle and move on. You know, the adage is, you're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good, right? And that's an unfortunate perception among some that are outside our tradition. But there's a greater sorrow and there's a greater tragedy to consider, and that is when we ourselves actually help them reinforce that perception. When we are we're fine with gathering here and singing our prayers, even a cappella, and doing our worship and hanging out together and doing potlucks and things like that, but when the surrounding world just sort of becomes like, meh. It's one thing to be present in the world. It's quite another thing to be present to the world. We're in a series, a brief series, and this is the last week of that series when we're refreshing our memory about what we consider to be sort of the crowning phrase that gives us the vision for our church, the vision of being faithfully present. 2 weeks ago, we talked about being present to God. Last week, we talked about being present to one another. This week, we're going to talk about what it means to be present to the world. We're going to look at three passages, brief passages in the book of Acts, that I think will unpack what it means to be present to the world. But in order to unpack it, we're asking ourselves two questions. What are the marks of being present to the world? How do you know you're there if you're there? And then secondly, how do you move from being present in it to being present to it? What are the marks? What is the motive for moving from being in to to? Will you stand? We're going to start in Acts chapter 2, starting in verse 42. Would you stand? Acts chapter 2, starting in verse 42. And they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. And awe came upon every soul. And many wonders and signs were being done through the apostles. And all who believed were together and had all things in common. And they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all as any had need. And day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they received their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to their number day by day those who were being saved. And then in chapter 5, starting in verse 12. Now many signs and wonders were regularly done among the people by the hands of the apostles, and they were all together in Solomon's portico. None of the rest dared join them, but the people held them in high esteem. And more than ever, believers were added to the Lord, multitudes of both men and women, so that they even carried out the sick into the streets and laid them on cots and mats, that as Peter came by, at least his shadow might fall on some of them. The people also gathered from the towns around Jerusalem, bringing the sick and those afflicted with unclean spirits, and they were all healed. And then in Acts chapter 17, starting in verse 1. Now when they, Paul and Silas, had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul went in, as was his custom, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead, and saying, "This Jesus, whom I proclaim to you, is the Christ." And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a great many of the devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading women. But the Jews were jealous, and taking some wicked men of the rabble, they formed a mob, set the city in an uproar, and attacked the house of Jason, seeking to bring them out to the crowd. And when they could not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brothers before the city authorities, shouting, "These men who have turned the world upside down have come here also. And Jason has received them, and they all are acting against the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, Jesus." And the people and the city authorities were disturbed when they heard these things. And when they had taken money as security from Jason and the rest, they let them go. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. How do you know when you're being present to the world? What are the marks of that so-called presence? We're, of course, going to talk about what the church does to be present to the world, but maybe it's first that we talk about how do you know if you're there? How do you know if what you're doing is accomplishing its ends? There are many things that would demonstrate that you have found what it means to be present to the world, but in these three passages, I'm finding at least two marks of being present to the world. Two things that is elicited from the world when your actions are doing as they should. Two things: approbation and perturbation. Or to be a little less pretentious, smiles and scowls. If that's happening, something's working. Let's talk about approbation first, the smile of the world. You might have caught it. It goes really fast. But in both the passage in chapter 2 and chapter 5, you get a glimpse of how the community that's surrounding the fledgling church is beginning to respond to its private and its public life. There at the end of chapter 2, it says, they receive their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having favor with all the people. And then in chapter 5, despite the blowback that the church is getting from the religious establishment, it says in verse 12 and 13 of chapter 5, many signs and wonders were regularly done. They were all together in the portico. None of the rest dared join them. But the people held them in high esteem. This odd band of people with this outlandish belief that their Lord and Savior had died and that was now again alive. This small but growing sect, which was drawing people together from across ethnic and linguistic and socioeconomic bounds, this people had turned a corner in the minds of its context. Now they were not just this spectacle, this mere religious spectacle. Now this had become a constituency that was to be lauded, to be favored. No matter how bizarre their beliefs were, you had to respect them. That's what's at work. Now, let's just be fair. Both passages don't elaborate very much on what elicited that favor and that esteem. But at least in chapter 2, we can be clear of this. The approbation that came from the community emerged at least on account of the kind of community the church was exhibiting. Who they were to each other was the church's face and public presence to the world. Brothers and sisters, our shared life here and outside here with each other is part of our presence to the world. So what was the nature of that community that elicited that kind of favor? The passage describes it in at least a few dimensions. One, they had a devotion to a common creed. Sitting, listening, taking in, meditating upon the apostles' teaching. That's what they were doing. They were partaking of the table. That's what it means, that they were receiving the bread. They were remembering the table that defined them, that grounded them. And they were giving themselves to prayers. It's talking about a kind of shaped liturgy that helped form their understanding of God and themselves. They were anchored. They weren't just there just sort of saying, well, we'll believe whatever we believe. You may have heard of this thing called the Sunday Assembly that's kind of kicked up here in the last couple of years. It's a group of former churchgoers that are now atheists that have said, you know what, we don't believe any of that rot in the Bible, but we kind of like a lot what the church does. We kind of like how they get together, they sing, they do stuff, they go out into the world. They love that. And they also revel in the fact that they have no creed, right? But look, brothers and sisters, if the Sunday's assemblies are around in about 10 years, guess what? They're going to have a binder. And that binder is going to have stuff that says, this is who we are, this is what we do, this is what we believe, this is what we don't believe. And it's going to draw a boundary. And this whole idea of being free-floating, give me a break. Any group of people to get together that have some sort of common purpose are going to develop a creed. Because they die if they don't. What drew the community outside them to the community that was in? They were anchored to something that was larger than themselves, that called them to submit to something. But they also were manifesting a community-wide stabilization. We've talked about this a lot in recent weeks. We've talked about how Barnabas would sell part of his property to stabilize those who were in need, and how that became a whole part of the church community. We're seeing that here also in chapter 2. All who believed, it says in verse 4, were together and had all things in common. They were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all as any had need. Those who had gave to those who had need. And as we said before, what's remarkable about this, it was not a compulsory form of redistribution, as much as the proto-communists might want to suggest that was in work. What makes it remarkable is that people were doing it out of their own free will. There wasn't this sort of guilt laying upon them. They just loved one another. And like any good body, if you're bleeding, you send resources to stanch the flow. It's what the body did. And that kind of interest, that kind of community-wide stabilization, it would spill out into beyond the boundaries of the community. It spills out. When we heard in chapter 5, when Peter comes to be known as the one who had allowed a lame man to rise up before him back in chapter 3. Not only does the church seek to find healing, but the whole city from Jerusalem starts bringing their people. Why? Because they know the church had compassion on those who were afflicted, whether or not they were of their number. Emperor Julian of the Roman Empire was the emperor in the mid-fourth century, and he's known in history as Julian the Apostate, because he outrightly and explicitly rejected Christian faith, despite the fact that the church had grown to such size in the Roman Empire to that point. But there's a famous letter that Julian the Apostate writes to one of his cabinet ministers. And in that letter, he is lamenting the indifference of Roman society to the lowest and weakest of that society. And at the same time, he's lamenting that cultural indifference. He is anguishing over what he finds as the exact opposite orientation among the Christian church. And so he says in that letter, why do we not observe that it is those Christians' benevolence to strangers, their care for the graves of the dead, and the pretended holiness of their lives that have done most to increase atheism? And in his word, atheism means, I no longer believe in Caesar, now I believe in Jesus. That's his version of atheism. And then he goes on to say, it's disgraceful that when no Jew ever has to beg, and these impious Christians support not only their own poor, but ours as well. All men see that our people lack aid from us. Oh, please teach those of the Greek faith to contribute to public service of this sort. In other words, the Christian church was shaming the Roman emperor and his culture because they had an outward face. Now, that's something of a prelude to the next point in this part, because that's a scowl, right? But Julian is talking about how the surrounding society was looking at the church and all it could do was make them smile and marvel at the charity that the church was showing that no one else was. There's a devotion to creed, there's a devotion to compassion, but look, brothers and sisters, it's not all crisis management and chanting, and it's not all giving and no play. They manifested a devotion just to a shared life with one another. At the end of chapter 2, it says, day by day, attending the temple together, breaking bread in their homes, they received their food with glad and generous hearts. What's that all about? That means they hung out with each other. That means they ate one another's food. They were just together. They're learning from one another. They're sharing one another's stories. They're enjoying one another. They're having game night. They're going on a camp out. They're having a cookout. They're with each other. It's their creed, it's their compassion, it's their common recreation that becomes a compelling image to the world. It's been a couple of years since I've shared with you another letter from antiquity. It's from the second century. It's written from an anonymous person who calls himself Mathetes, which is the word for disciple. And he is writing a letter to an attaché of then Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius. And the name of that attaché was named Diognetus. And in that letter, he is describing what sets the early church apart from the surrounding culture. And he writes this. There's something extraordinary about their lives. They live in their own countries as though they were only passing through. They play their full role as citizens, but labor under all the disabilities of aliens. Any country can be their homeland. But for them, their homeland, wherever it may be, is a foreign country. Like others, they marry, have children, but they don't expose them. They share their meals, but not their wives. They live in the flesh, but they're not governed by the desires of the flesh. They pass their days upon earth, but they're citizens of heaven. The world was taking note. The nature of the church community was its own outward posture toward the world, and it was compelling. Why? Why did that stick? Why did it make them take notice? Why did it work? Look, brothers and sisters, I think you'd agree, treating one another with dignity, even to your own disadvantage, is in itself compelling, right? Several weeks ago, I think I shared with you, there's a guy named Hemant Mehta. He's on the web. He calls himself the friendly atheist. And he's out to kind of disabuse people of the alleged awfulness of atheists, right? And he was in a conversation online a couple of years ago with a woman who had been an atheist, but then converted to Roman Catholicism. Her name's Leah Labresco. And they were talking back and forth about why she had come to faith and why he still thinks faith is bizarre. And he acknowledged, he went on a year-long tour through churches throughout the country, and at the end of that tour, he said this, they didn't compel me to believe in what they believe, but you know what? They take care of one another like nobody else does. John Oliver, he's kind of the heir apparent of John Stewart. He's funny, he's bawdy, let the buyer beware, but he's insightful. Last week, he does this 20-minute expose on televangelists. And in some ways, it was spot on. But he prefaces that whole tirade on televangelists by saying what? There are churches out there who do lots of great things, who are feeding the poor and clothing the naked and caring for the sick. I'm not talking about those churches. Why would he even see fit to make that kind of prefacing statement? Because he realizes what the church does in its public presence to the world is something to be reckoned with. That's compelling, clearly. The other reason why I think their common life was so compelling to the surrounding world is that they understood the difference between evangelism and salesmanship. What? What do I mean? Look, guy rings my doorbell, okay? Despite the little friendly sign next to my door that says, thanks, we love our vacuum cleaner, we already found God, and we gave it the office. You know, that doesn't work very often. Need a new sign. Or put it in neon. Guy still rings my doorbell, right? And he's trying to sell me lawn care service, right? I don't know him. I don't have any reason to think he's trying to mislead me or that he's trying to be conniving, but do I really think that he really believes in the lawn care that he's trying to sell me? Does he at night pore over the manuals about lawn care because he delights in the science of aeration and fertilization and irrigation? Does he really love that so much? You know what? I think this is what he believes in. He believes in food. He believes in having a nice pair of shoes. He believes in being able to take his wife out to dinner. And so he has to believe in lawn care because he really believes in those other things. And that's why I'm saying this. Salesmanship is about putting something forth because there's something else in the background that you're really working for, but you give every impression that you really believe in what you're selling. Brothers and sisters, evangelism is not that. If you think evangelism is about so that God will like you more, then you are about the business of salesmanship. St. Augustine, before he was ever converted to Christianity, traveled to Rome to meet Ambrose, who was a theologian, an orator, and a pastor. And at first, Augustine loved listening to Ambrose, not because of anything that he said, but because of the way he said it. He was just amazed at his oratorical skills. He didn't believe a thing about what Ambrose was saying. But in time, Augustine, upon reflection, after he'd become a Christian, said this about Ambrose. That man of God received me like a father and expressed pleasure at my coming with a kindness most fitting in a bishop. I began to like him at first, indeed not as a teacher of the truth, for I had absolutely no confidence in your church, but as a human being who was kind to me. People can smell you a mile away if what you're out to share is for some other reason than that you love them or that you want to be kind to them. The early church knew the difference between that, between evangelism and salesmanship. It didn't speak of God. It didn't manifest God in order to get in good with God. It didn't give in order to get. It was just public with its faith and lavish with its mercy. Brothers and sisters, do you want to be evangelistic? Do you want to be persuasive? Then love one another here. Take care of one another here. Be disadvantaged for one another here. That's compelling, but it's also a laboratory. Because as you practice that among each other, you are preparing yourself to be able to do that beyond ourselves. We don't tie our willingness to be present to the world and indeed to the response of a smile. But one sure mark of being present to the world is the approbation from it. But not just approbation. Here's the other part of it. Here's the flip side of it, brothers and sisters. There's also perturbation. There's also the scowl. And if you're not ready for it, you need to be. It's not all wine and roses. You know that. We're going to come back to the passage in Acts chapter 17 later in more detail. I just want to give you the big picture. Paul and Silas, they're in Thessalonica. It's on the edge of what is now Turkey, right? They go to the synagogue to engage the Jews. They're there. Some are persuaded. Some Greeks are persuaded. Some of the highest standing women in the culture are persuaded. But the others who are not persuaded, they go nuts. And they go off on Paul and Silas. And they find a believer there whose name is Jason. And they take him to the city authorities. And there they lodge a complaint. And they say, "These men who have turned the world upside down have come into here also." And then they say, "They're all acting against the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another King Jesus." They mix a little truth with a little lie. Yeah, they do say that Jesus is Lord, but they're not out to subvert the decrees of Caesar. Remember what Jesus said? "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." It's not anarchy that Jesus was espousing, nor was it Paul and Silas. The outcome of the whole incident there is in verse 8. The people and the city authorities were disturbed when they heard these things. Disturbed. It's the Greek word tarachos. It shows up only 4 times in the New Testament, and every one of them is in the book of Acts. Where the church goes, tarachos, disturbance, breaks out. A chapter earlier, Paul is exercising an oppressive spirit from a girl who'd been enslaved by merchants for her fortune-telling gifts. And these merchants are now out of a huge income stream. And they take Paul to the magistrate and say, "These men are Jews. They are disturbing our city." Now, in that case, the presence of the church is localized through 2 people. But the way that they were being present, they were disrupting the status quo. They were challenging the way things were. They weren't out to create a disturbance. That wasn't their point or their purpose. But what they did inevitably created a disturbance. Now, why is that? Just a couple reasons. To be present to the world is to at times press against the conventional wisdom about what has ultimate authority. Now, there are times where you can be in submission to a lesser authority and to God simultaneously, and there's no conflict. You can work for your boss, and he can ask you to do stuff, and you can reasonably and affably respond to his commands without incident. There's no problem there. But if you listen just to the prophet Daniel, who worked for 2 Persian kings at the same time that he was in submission to God, and he did both of those just fine and affably and with great integrity. But there are times when the will of a lesser authority and the will of God diverge, and therefore to be present to God and to the world simultaneously is sometimes to have to refuse to follow a certain way that conflicts with God's will. If you're asked to do something that is unjust in the eyes of God, if you're asked to cut a deal that is unjust or unkind or defames, to refuse to do that is to be present to the world. The defiance is an act of faithful presence, because presence sometimes demands pressing against authority. But secondly, the other reason why it has to do that, why disturbance comes, is that to be present to the world is also to press against unjust structures that benefit some to the degradation of others. If you're asked to participate in an effort that disenfranchises some or defames others, refusing to follow that directive, even if it costs you, is at the heart of what it means to be present to the world. There's a quote on the front of your bulletin that says this: "The force that moves the sun and the stars takes the side of the poor and won't let the graves of the innocent keep their hold on the dead forever." You and I love to think about Jesus having power over death and hell. And that's a good thing. It should give us consolation. But you and I can never uncouple God's concern with overturning death from his concern for answering poverty. To whatever extent, then, brothers and sisters, that we are aware of or even participants in what deprives the poor, we have to press against those structures. Gaining the smile of the world through your presence is preferable, I know that. But provoking the scowl of the world is sometimes just as necessary, even if it's not equally gratifying. Smiles and scowls, they go hand in hand. Do you see why they have to go hand in hand? Many times the efforts we take to seek the welfare of some and elicits their smile will inevitably disturb others and elicit their ire. At times, there is no defending some without having to offend others. It just works like that. But on the flip side, you can't just be content with offending some because it's serving the good of others. Look, I'm following the whole video series litany to Planned Parenthood as much as you might be. And as you'd expect, social media is letting fly all of the epithets and recriminations and snarky words. Unfortunately, a lot of it is coming out of the church's mouth. I know that we ought to defend the rights of the unborn at every turn that we can. But brothers and sisters, if the effort to defend the unborn only results in unleashing a torrent of epithets like murderers and merchants of death, something's gotten lost in the strategy. To be present to the world surely calls for defending the weakest, even if it offends some, but it also means finding a way not just to call out, but to pull a seat up and have a conversation that might emerge, that might move past condemnation towards something more redemptive. A conversation where somebody's mind actually might be changed instead of just excoriating a perspective. That's being present to the world, brothers and sisters. Smiles and scowls will always be inseparable outcomes. If you're hoping just for smiles, and it's likely you're not going to be willing to do the necessary things that are going to bring forth a scowl. But if you only delight in provoking a scowl, then it may be that you're more interested in picking a fight than in loving your enemies. Those marks have to go together if either of them are going to sit, if either of us are going to be faithfully present. And so we're going to be present in word and in deed. We're going to continue to proclaim the Lord Jesus at every time people come into our midst. And we're going to be continuing to train ourselves in what it means to be in a third place. Not just your home, not just your work, but somewhere where you can create relationships that maybe give you an opportunity to be kind, like Ambrose was kind to Augustine, such that maybe one day a word might be spoken that moves past just the kindness. We're going to do that to be present to the world. And we're going to be present to the world indeed. As soon as we get to Canterbury School, we're going to ask, how can we help your school? How can we help your students? As soon as I sit down with Father Harris at St. Anne Episcopal, I'm going to ask him if it's right. Can we be of help? Can we be of assistance to the community that you're already assistance to? We want to be present to the world. As soon as the Mercy Cohort forms, Lord willing, it's going to inquire about what is going on in this region, perhaps, that we might become partnership with. Some will approve of what we do. Some are going to be disturbed by what we do. We're not going to aim for either of those, but we probably should expect both. So how are we going to hit the marks? How are we going to get the smiles and the scowls? That's the last thing I need to talk about, and then we're done. It's not going to be a rousing speech. It's not even going to be a sermon. Because look, if we're going to be faithfully present to our world, we're going to have to be cured. Because there are lots of reasons we're not going to be faithfully present to the world for that don't just happen with a snap of a fingers. It requires a change of heart. We're going to have to be cured of our indifference to the whole enterprise. I got my own problems. I don't have any time. I'm too tired. We have to be cured of our indifference. We have to be cured of our fear of what might happen if we try to be present, because there is going to be scowls and probably worse. We're also going to have to be cured mostly of our pride of self-absorption. Brothers and sisters, we are sick with the self and we have to be cured. So we need a change of heart. And I'm not trying to get political here, but when Hillary Clinton met with some of the leaders of the Black Lives Matter group or effort this week, sort of impromptu, I think she said something rather astute. She said, you can't change hearts with a movement. Meaning, you can't just sort of create an effort and people's hearts will be changed. She said, you can change laws, you can reallocate funds, you can change structures, but to think that a movement is going to change hearts, it won't. Maybe a few, but not globally, not even nationally, maybe not even citywide. You can't change everyone's hearts. And again, I'm not getting political here. I'm saying no law will change hearts. But Martin Luther King Jr. did say this. Yes, right. You can't legislate morality. You can't keep a man from hating me, but you can create a law that keeps him from lynching me. So laws do matter, but hearts matter more. To be present to our world such that we sacrifice ourselves in ways that might draw a smile or risk ourselves that might draw a scowl. You and I need something to cure our heart of indifference, fear, and pride. What will do that? This will not be a shock to you. Last week, we talked about the gladness of the grace of God. If we know the grace of God, we'll be gladdened by it, and that will compel us to be present to one another. But in verse 47 of chapter 2, it says of the church, they receive their food with glad and generous hearts. Generosity. What do you have to do? What do you have to believe? What has to happen to make you feel generous? At least two things. Generosity flows from believing that you have all you need and that it really is nothing to give away what you have. Generosity flows from wanting all the good for another person. That's where generosity comes from. Brothers and sisters, there's a reason we started our worship service with Psalm 22. If you know that psalm, it is the cry of dereliction from Jesus' mouth when he is on the cross. And in that moment, he is crying out to his God who seems absent to him. But in that moment, he has never been more present to the world in dying for it. The gospel of Jesus Christ will always inspire generosity. The gospel of Jesus says this to you, brothers and sisters, that everything you have is a gift. But even if you lost every red cent, you would have more than the richest person on the earth, because the inheritance you have from him is larger than that. It is full of resurrection hope, and it makes all other assets pale. And from that belief, generosity flows. It also flows from the truth that God is for you. Because of what Jesus did, God is for you. But the fact that even before Jesus set foot on the earth, when he laid in a manger, the fact that God sent him is proof that God is already for you. He has made you good in his sight because of what his son did. And therefore, you don't have to spend the rest of your life trying to make yourself into something, trying to prove that you're good, because the Father has already found you good through the good work of his son. And when you know that, you are freed. Free to seek the good of others. Seymour Bernstein is an 88-year-old concert pianist of whom Ethan Hawke, of all people, has just done a documentary. I'm looking forward to seeing it. But Seymour Bernstein, in a rather candid moment, said this: when you do something for someone else, it temporarily distracts you from your own vulnerability. When you do something for someone else, it temporarily distracts you from your own vulnerability. What does that mean? Pretty thick, pretty pithy. Forgetting yourself for a moment for the sake of another helps you forget for just a moment how weak you really are. You have to. If you're consumed by your weakness, you won't think of somebody else. But if you forget that for just a moment, you can. And in that moment, there is wonder and freedom. Brothers and sisters, if it is our sense of weakness that keeps us from forgetting ourselves, then what if I were to tell you that there is a love that is not of this world, that knows just how weak and sinful you really are and yet loves you anyway? That's the gospel. That's the gospel of Psalm 22. That's the gospel of Jesus. If you and I believe that, do you realize how free you and I would be to do something for others, not temporarily, but regularly? The will of the Father, through the work of the Son, by the presence of the Spirit, confirms to you the enduring love that knows your weakness and loves you anyway. And it gives you a new identity. It gives you something like a new name. Like Sister Mary Cynthia got a new name. At the same time, she got a new call. We are given a new identity that sends us out into a new posture to the world. For the world as God is for the world. For the world as God is for us. No more, no less. Amen.